We pause for a moment this morning to listen to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 39, and this morning's three-point sermon upon it. Well, either it is a three-point sermon or 3 points in search of a sermon. While there are easier sentences which might tempt us here in this reading, we shall listen to the hardest for interpreters. Do not resist one who is evil. As today's reading reminds us, we are from a deep, though intricately varied, ethical tradition that enshrines selfless love, Christocentric love, cruciform love as the cherished ideal of human behavior. You have heard that it was said, "You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." But I say to you, love your enemies. We reflect this morning first on the personal dimension, second on the social dimension, and third on the contemporary dimension of our verse. Do not resist one who is evil. If anyone smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Coat, cloak, 1 mile, 2. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? At the outset with these verses, we shall stay with the heavy emphasis they clearly have on personal relationships, where the ice is thicker and we are safer. For an individual, alone and with no responsibilities to others, there are often options for selfless self-sacrifice. Our own striking remembrances of times when we have seen this verse practiced restore us. For example, a new bishop came to us just after our first year in college. He loved golf and would happily take a summer afternoon to play with some of his preachers and sometimes with their sons. This was a different era, and before the more pronounced current separation of those superintending from those superintended, the general and district superintendents, it was more steadily then remembered, were simply ministers, fellow elders assigned to different sorts of work. The color purple was not so often in evidence. As one of the chief influences of our entrance into pastoral work, it is a supreme happiness to remember his kindness, his humility, and his example. I see him carefully washing hands and then offering a prayer with 12-year-olds at summer camp. There in memory he is carrying hymnals downstairs after he had spoken on the district. We served Joe spaghetti in a modest New York apartment, and he was easy and at home. One August, he and three others were playing golf on a public course in the heat. After the round, all stopped for a soda in the clubhouse, another era, well before Methodist clergy could drink a beer, at least in front of each other or in front of the bishop. Another group asked if they had seen a putter one had left behind, and my friend remembered. A foursome at that nearby table muttered and groused about Joe and me not picking up one of their clubs that lay near a green. I was getting angry, not Joe. He got up and walked to the far side of the course to see if the club was still there. Not finding it, he returned without saying a word to our mouthy detractors. I have always looked upon this incident as a marvelous lesson in practical Christianity. For example, perhaps you too had a grandmother who baked cherry pies on February 22nd. The cherry tree myth is the most well-known and longest enduring legend about our first president, George Washington, whose birthday we honor this week and weekend. This month we have remembered James Baldwin and Frederick Douglass, and we have sung the hymns of Tindley Temple as well. We also recall Lincoln and Washington. In the original story, when Washington was 6 years old, he received a hatchet as a gift and damaged his father's cherry tree. When his father discovered what he had done, he became angry and confronted him. And young George bravely said, "I cannot tell a lie. I did cut it down with my hatchet." Washington's father embraced him and rejoiced that his son's honesty was worth more than 1,000 trees. Character, kindness, matter. For example, in one suburban neighborhood this autumn, a young family worked hard and were disappointed by the results of the elections. Their windows and their lawn were adorned with campaign material. You knew where they stood. When the snow came, an older neighbor one block away, who had a new snowblower and some extra time, plowed out his neighbor's sidewalks and driveways. By accident, at a holiday party, the young family learned that their kind plowman had voted for and staunchly supported the opposing party. The snow removal continued and is still going on. But we need to be careful here, even here where the ice is pretty thick. The words in this verse here are plural in command. You, plural, must not resist, but singular in object, one who is or does evil. The teaching, that is, applies to individual behavior, though it is given to all. What you may be free to do or not to do on your own is not a freedom available in the main to groups, institutions, and societies. So Niebuhr taught us. An individual may sacrifice his own interests, either without hope of reward or in the hope of an ultimate compensation. But how is an individual who is responsible for the interests of a group to justify the sacrifice of interests other than his own? No one has a right to be unselfish with other people's interests. Fewer risks can be taken with community interests than with individual interests. To some degree, the conflict between the purest individual morality and an adequate political policy must therefore remain. Hence the title of his great book, Moral Man and Immoral Society. The harder second question, and the spot on the pond where the ice gets thin, or at least thinner, is regarding how far the principle can be applied to groups, and especially to political life. Our recognition that the dominant alto tenor voices of the early church and evangelists, expecting the soon and very soon return of Christ, and hence shading this ethic as an interim ethic, we this winter rely on Albert Schweitzer and Amos Wilder here, may help us. How shall we hear this verse in relation to the brief span of human history given to our keeping? While there are easier applications, we shall today head straight into the hardest, the Christian ethical teaching on the place of military might. It needs no particular emphasis today to recognize that behind the fury and flurry of daily news, cable news that should have less viewership, major newspapers that need more calm and balance, millennials and baby boomers both who need fewer protests and more contests, fewer protests and more projects, there looms the prospect ever present across the globe of armed conflict. Matthew 5:39 says, "Resist not." So how shall we hear this verse? Over 20 centuries, and speaking with unforgivable conciseness, as one must in a 20-minute sermon, two basic understandings of war and peace have emerged in Christian thought. As you know, these roughly can be called the pacifist and just war understandings. We need to know this. Pacifism preceded its sibling and infinitely extends to all times the interim ethic of the Sermon on the Mount, which, here in Matthew, a late writing, expects that the coming of Christ will soon make moot our ethical dilemmas and so tends to err on the side of the personal, on the side of quietism, or in the case of arms, pacifism. To him who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. Many utterly saintly Christian women and men have and do honor this understanding with their selfless commitment, including some in this congregation today. My own pulpit hero, Ernest Fremont Tittle, the best Methodist preacher of the 20th century, did so from his Chicago pulpit through the whole of the Second World War. My namesake, Ellen Knight Chalmers, did so in pulpit and classroom near the same time, right here in Boston. Think about that for a moment. While personally I have not been able to this date anyway entirely to agree with either of them, I never compose a sermon on this topic without wondering, and to some degree fearing, what their judgment might be. The multiple theories of just war, or war as the least of all evil alternatives, have developed since the 4th century, and particularly since the writing of St. Augustine. Here the command to be merciful, even as God is merciful, is understood tragically to include times when mercy for the lamb means armed opposition to the wolf. The New Testament apocalyptic frame and its interim ethic are honored, to be sure, but supplemented with the historic experience of the church through the ages. Many utterly saintly Christian men and women have honored this understanding with their selfless commitment, including some present here today, and some who are not present because they gave their lives that others might live. Just war thought includes several serious caveats. We need to know this. A just cause in response to serious evil, a just intention for restoration of peace with justice, an absence of self-enrichment or desire for devastation, a use as an utterly last resort, a claim of legitimate authority, and a reasonable hope of success given the constraints of discrimination and proportionality, usually understood as protection of non-combatants. Response, restoration, restraint, last resort, common authority. Prayerfully, we each and we all will want to consider our own understanding, our own Christian understanding of Christian ethics, our own choice and choices between these two basic alternatives. But the careful listener this February of 2017 will want and need a thought or two about how, together, as those who influence culture together, we might positively and proactively live out Matthew 5:39. Our age and our world are embedded with nuclear weaponry, which, by grace, with luck thus far since 1945, has not been used. But as one wrote last week, luck is not a plan, and luck tends to run out. We are keenly aware as well that in the nuclear age, the temperament, judgment, and character of those in positions of dispositive power are crucial. We are aware as well of the influence for good and ill that leadership carries, including the power to shred inherited, long-standing forms of etiquette, diplomacy, and culture on an hourly, daily basis. We do well as well to remember that the wise and primary impetus for globalization is not market economics, but lasting security. So far in this sermon, we have offered first a qualified application of our verse to personal ethics, and second, a qualified separation of the verse from literal use in social ethics. Third, what does the verse call for through us today? We will pause now to welcome a visitor to our service. Welcome. You'll welcome him. You'll find him to my right and down the west aisle of the chapel. He's standing alone and has been with us before. Actually, his worship attendance at Marsh Chapel has been perfect for 60 years, every Sunday, a far better record than he had in life. For he is enshrined in one of our conic stained glass windows, one of the many novel choices the fourth president of Boston University, Daniel Marsh, made in designing our chapel. Abraham Lincoln may be able to offer us some assistance today on President's Weekend. In the fall of 1855, two men as different as life and death stood beside each other on debate platforms in Illinois. To the right was the carefully groomed, smooth-speaking, dapperly dressed Senator Stephen Douglas. To his left looking like a bumpkin, stood a gangly, homely man, overly tall and saddled with a high-pitched, irritating voice. They debated for the heart of the country, and Lincoln lost. In his career, he lost and lost and lost. In 1858, he lost, even though virtually every point he made in his speeches proved true. A house divided against itself cannot stand. Accustomed to trample on the rights of others, you have lost the genius of your own independence. Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves. True, true, true. He won in 1860, but in 1862, his party was thrashed. He said, "I'm too big to cry and too badly hurt to laugh." And in 1863, the horror of Gettysburg quickened his finest address. And in 1864, challenged by his own subordinate, he barely won. And in 1865, on Good Friday, he too was dead. Lincoln spoke of his beloved country in the soaring phrase, "the last best hope." Lincoln, who lost and lost and lost, exemplified a lifelong resistance to resentment. He got up and he tried again, time after time. He did not let the inevitable resentments of life stymie him. He was a loser, not a winner, but he resisted resentment. Lincoln resisted resentment and, by example, guides us as well. Sometimes it is better to have patience than brains. If we can restrain ourselves in the future from making scapegoats of some in order furiously to retaliate against other hidden foes, that is, we shall find that the community of peoples around the globe will see in us, again, a last best hope. We may model, as a people, a path forward into a time of freedom, pluralism, toleration, compromise, and peace. Here Lincoln holds a key for us, a dream and hope of malice toward none. We may be entering an epoch of spiritual discipline against resentment. Here I simply refer to a great American and a greater historian, Christopher Lash, and his rumination on the work of Reinhold Niebuhr. He wrote, "The only way to break the endless cycle of injustice," Niebuhr argued, "was nonviolent coercion." Nonviolent coercion, with its spiritual discipline against resentment. In order to undermine an oppressor's claims to moral superiority, one has to avoid such claims on their own behalf. Again, in the confines of a sermon, one can only sketch. Lash's essay distilled this theme, a spiritual discipline against resentment, from the lives and writings of Niebuhr, but also Martin Luther King, but also the Boston personalists and many others. He saw, as we too may see in the Matthean passage earlier read, the necessity of holding at bay those deeply human sentiments that easily and tragically attach themselves to us when we are fearful, when we are attacked, when we are violated. For a future to emerge that is more than simply a repetition of the patterns of the past, a people, our people, we the people, will have to develop such a spiritual discipline against resentment. What is this discipline? What does it look like? How is one to find its power? Truly, I see no other source than a confessional reliance on the Christ of Calvary, and no better reading than the one we heard a moment ago, Matthew 5, 38 and following. Frederick Douglass reminds us, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters." a spiritual discipline against resentment. It is quotidian, it is tedious, it is daily work, and it will consume easily for each of us the next decade. It was the genius of Isaiah Berlin, with whom we conclude, which best bespoke this wise admonition to a discipline, yours against resentment, he wrote. Collisions, even if they cannot be avoided, can be softened. Claims can be balanced. Compromises can be reached. In concrete situations, not every claim is of equal force. So much liberty, so much equality, so much for sharp moral condemnation, so much for understanding a given situation, so much for the full force of law, and so much for the prerogative of mercy, for feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, healing the sick, sheltering the homeless. Priorities, never final or absolute, must be established. Of course, social or political collisions will take place. The mere conflict of positive values alone makes this unavoidable. Yet they can be minimized by promoting and preserving an uneasy equilibrium which is constantly threatened and in constant need of repair. That alone is the precondition for decent societies and morally acceptable behavior. Otherwise, we are bound to lose our way. A little dull as a solution, you will say? Yet there is great truth in this. For you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You therefore must be whole, even as your heavenly Father is holy. Amen.